Kicks on Sunday night. Welcome to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's Kicks 935. My show tonight is about facts, and it's not easy in this day and age to separate facts from fiction. Sometimes the facts don't fit well into our narrative. Sometimes the facts aren't as lyrical as we would wish, and so we have poetry and fiction and art. Here's a rather sweet story illustrating that.
In England, there's a pop singer, one of the top popular singers in England today, Katie Melua. She's sort of the Nora Jones of the UK. And she wrote a beautiful song. It was in top five in 2005 called 9 Million Bicycles in Beijing. It's a love story about how much she loves her guy compared to 9 million bicycles and so forth. And she has this one passage here.
We are 12 billion light years from the edge. That's a guess. No one can ever say it's true, but I know that I will always be with you.
Well, that's nice. At least you got it close. But my friend Simon Singh, the particle physicist now turned science educator, and he wrote the book The Big Bang and so on, uses every chance he gets to promote good science. And so he wrote an op-ed piece in The Guardian about Katie's song in which he said, well, we know exactly how far from the edge, it's 13.7 billion light years. And it's not a guess. We know within a precise error bars there how close it is. And so we can say, although not absolutely true, that it's pretty close to being true. And to his credit, Katie called him up after this op-ed piece came out and said, I'm so embarrassed. I was a member of the astronomy club and I should have known better. And she recut the song.
We are 13.7 billion light years from the edge of the observable universe. That's a good estimate. Well-defined error bars, and with the available information, I predict that I will always be with you.
How cool is that?
Very cool, huh? That was a clip from the TED Talk of Michael Shermer, who is the director of the Skeptics Society, an important organization that does try to separate facts from fiction, particularly in the area of the paranormal. I actually interviewed CFIs, that's the Center for Inquiries, Jim Underdown, a while back on the kinds of stories people come to them with to verify strange bangs in the night. It's kind of a fun job to go into people's houses to analyze whether it really is ghosts or whether it's something explicable, which, of course, for members of this association, it pretty much always is. So there is the paranormal. It's really impossible to say definitively that the paranormal doesn't exist. There are some things that are beyond our comprehension, but for those things that are within our comprehension, there are verifiable facts. And then there are non-facts presented as facts, which we seem to have been having rather an influx of lately without naming names. But it's very important that we do identify facts, that facts are probably curated by reliable sources and not fed to us as propaganda when there's no foundation to them. So in this age where we do get most of our facts online, it's crucial that we pay proper attention to whether there's truth to them or not. And there are a few methods for doing that. Here on my KX935 Sharon Hour, that's for me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only public FM radio station, KX935. Let's hear in his TED Talk, Malcolm Nolan, tell us how he goes about sifting through all the stuff presented online and in YouTube videos to verify whether it's something trumped up, as it were, or reliable that we're being presented with.
I've been a journalist now since I was about 17, and it's an interesting industry to be in at the moment because, as you all know, there's a huge amount of upheaval going on in media. But the upheaval that I'm interested in is not in the output side, it's on the input side. It's concerned with how we get information and how we gather the news. And that's changed because we've had a huge shift in the balance of power from the news organizations to the audience. And the audience for such a long time was in a position where they didn't have any way of affecting the news or making any change. They couldn't really connect. And that's changed irrevocably. And my first connection with the news media was when, in 1984, the BBC had a one-day strike. I wasn't happy. I was angry. I couldn't see my cartoons. So I wrote a letter. It's a very effective way of ending your hate mail. Love, Markham, aged 4. Still works. I'm not sure if I had any impact on the one-day strike, but what I do know is that it took them 3 weeks to get back to me. And that was the round journey. It took that long for anyone to have any impact and get some feedback. And that's changed now because as journalists, we interact in real time. We're not in a position where the audience is reacting to news. We're reacting to the audience. We're actually relying on them. They're helping us find the news. They're helping us figure out what is the best angle to take and what's the stuff that they want to hear. So it's a real-time thing. It's much quicker. It's happening on a constant basis, and the journalist is always playing catch-up. To give an example of how we rely on the audience, an earthquake hit in Costa Rica. It was a 7.6 magnitude. It was fairly big. And the ground shook in Managua 60 seconds after it hit the epicenter. 30 seconds later, the first message went onto Twitter. And this was someone saying, temblor, which means earthquake. So 60 seconds was how long it took for the physical earthquake to travel. 30 seconds later, news of that earthquake had traveled all around the world instantly. Everyone in the world, hypothetically, had the potential to know that an earthquake was happening in Managua. And that happened because this one person had a documentary instinct, which was to post a status update, which is what we all do now. So if something happens, we put a status update, or we post a photo, we post a video, and it all goes up into the cloud in a constant stream. And what that means is just constant, huge volumes of data going up. It's actually staggering. When you look at the numbers, every minute, there are 72 more hours of video on YouTube. So that's every second more than an hour of video gets uploaded. And in photos, Instagram, 58 photos are uploaded to Instagram a second. More than 3,500 photos go up onto Facebook. So by the time I'm finished talking here, there'll be 864 more hours of video on YouTube than there were when I started, and 2.5 million more photos on Facebook and Instagram than when I started. So it's an interesting position to be in as a journalist because we should have access to everything. Any event that happens anywhere in the world, I should be able to know about it pretty much instantaneously for free. The only problem is when you have that much information, you have to find the good stuff. And that can be incredibly difficult when you're dealing with those volumes. And nowhere was this brought home more than during Hurricane Sandy. So what you had in Hurricane Sandy was a superstorm, the likes of which we hadn't seen for a long time, hitting the iPhone capital of the universe, and you got volumes of media like we'd never seen before. That meant that journalists had to deal with fakes. So we had to deal with old photos that were being reposted. We had to deal with composite images.
And that's the problem. Photos can lie. This journalist mentions that there were photos that actually were stills from films like The Day After Tomorrow, or they were just from previous storms represented as current ones. And all of this is well and good so long as it's stated and everyone knows the difference between the represented version and the actual version. So the facts have to fit the actual facts, as it were. You can't just present old facts and squeeze them in as if they were current ones. So what is a fact comes under question. That's what my Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX 935 is all about tonight. Journalist Malcolm Nolan, in his TED Talk, is telling us about trying to get a verifiable visual portrayal of a hurricane as it was happening and make sure he wasn't being presented with an archival one that was just generically representative.
We had to deal with images that were so realistic, it was nearly difficult to tell if they were real at all. Images like one from Instagram from Avenue C in downtown Manhattan, which is flooded, which was subjected to a grilling by journalists. The lighting was questioned, everything was questioned about it. And the reason that they could tell that it was real was because they could get to the source. And in this case, these guys were New York food bloggers. They were well-respected, they were known. So it was actually something they could prove. And that was the job of the journalist. It was filtering all this stuff. And instead of going and finding the information and bringing it back to the reader, you were holding back the stuff that was potentially damaging. Finding the source becomes more and more important, finding the good source. Twitter is where most journalists now go. It's like the de facto real-time newswire, if you know how to use it, because there is so much on Twitter. Sometimes you come across a piece of content that is so compelling, you're dying to use it, but you're not 100% sure if you can because you don't know if the source is credible, and you have to do that investigative work. And this video, which I'm going to let run through.
This video was shot in a storm, and it shows a swimming pool enclosed in a solarium of glass. It actually shows the storm sweeping through, knocking over the umbrella as it tore past, making the whole room sway. It's quite dramatic.
Getting real windy in just a second.
So So now, if you're a news producer, this is something you love to run with, because obviously this is gold. You know, this is a fantastic reaction from someone, very genuine video that they've shot in their back garden. But how do you find if this is true, if it's faked, or if it's something that's old and it's been reposted? So we set about going to work on this video, and the only thing that we had to go on was the username on the YouTube account. There was only one video posted to that account, and the username was Rita Krill. And we didn't know if Rita existed or if it was a fake name. But we started looking, and we used free internet tools to do so. The first one was called Spokio, which allowed us to look for Rita Krills. So we looked all over the US. We found them in New York, we found them in Pennsylvania, Nevada, and Florida. So we went and we looked for a second free internet tool called Wolfram Alpha, and we checked the weather reports for the day which this video had been uploaded. And when we went through all those various cities, we found that in Florida, there was thunderstorms and rain on the day. So we went to the White Pages, and we looked through the Rita Krills in the phone book, and we looked through a couple of different addresses. And that took us to Google Maps, where we found a house. And we found a house with a swimming pool that looked remarkably like Rita's. So we went back to the video, and we had to look for clues that we could cross-reference. So in the video, there's a big umbrella, there's a white lilo in the pool, there are some unusually rounded edges in the swimming pool, and there's two trees in the background. And we went back to Google Maps, and we looked a little bit closer, and sure enough, there's the white lilo, there are the two trees, there's the umbrella, it's actually folded in this photo, a little bit of trickery, and there are the rounded edges on the swimming pool. So we were able to call Rita, clear the video, make sure that it had been shot, and then our clients were delighted because they were able to run it without being worried. Sometimes the search for truth, though, is a little bit less flippant, and it has much greater consequences. Syria has been really interesting for us because, obviously, a lot of the time you're trying to debunk stuff that can be potentially war crime evidence. So this is where YouTube actually becomes the most important repository of information about what's going on in the world. So this video from Hama. And what shows, when you watch the whole thing through, is bloodied bodies being taken out of a pickup truck and thrown off a bridge. The allegations were that these guys were Muslim Brotherhood, and they were throwing Syrian army officers' bodies off the bridge, and they were cursing and using blasphemous language, and there was lots of counterclaims about who they were and whether or not they were what the video said it was. So we talked to some sources in Hama who we had been back and forth with on Twitter, and we asked them about this, and the bridge was interesting to us because it's something we could identify. Three different sources said three different things about the bridge. They said, one, the bridge doesn't exist. Another one said the bridge does exist, but it's not in Hama, it's somewhere else. And the third one said, I think the bridge does exist, but the dam upstream of the bridge was closed, so the river should actually have been dry, so this doesn't make sense. So that was the only one that gave us a clue. We looked through the video for other clues. We saw the distinctive railings, which we could use. We looked at the curbs. The curbs were throwing shadows south, so we could tell that the bridge was running east-west across the river. It had black and white curbs. As we looked at the river itself, you could see there's a concrete stone on the west side. There's a cloud of blood. That's blood in the river. The river's flowing south to north. And also, as you look away from the bridge, there's a divot on the left-hand side of the bank, and the river narrows. So onto Google Maps we go, and we start looking through literally every single bridge. We go to the dam that we talked about. We start just literally going through every time that road crosses the river, crossing off the bridges that don't match. We're looking for one that crosses east-west. And we get to Hama. We get all the way from the dam to Hama, and there's no bridge. So we go a bit further. We switch to the satellite view, and we find another bridge, and everything starts to line up. The bridge looks like it's crossing the river east to west. So this could be our bridge. And we zoom right in. We start to see that it's got a median, so it's a two-lane bridge. And it's got the black and white curbs that we saw in the video. And as we click through it, someone's uploaded photos to go with the map, which is very handy. So we click into the photos. And the photos start showing us more detail that we can cross-reference with the video. The first thing that we see is black and white curbing, which is handy because we've seen that before. We see the distinctive railing that we saw the guys throwing the bodies over. And we keep going through it until we're certain that this is our bridge. So what does that tell me? I've got to go back now to my three sources and look at what they told me. The one who said the bridge didn't exist, the one who said the bridge wasn't in Hama, and the one guy who said, yes, the bridge does exist, but I'm not sure about the water levels. Number three is looking like the most truthful all of a sudden. And we've been able to find that out using some free internet tools, sitting in a cubicle in an office in Dublin in the space of 20 minutes. And that's part of the joy of this. Although the web is running like a torrent, there's so much information there that it's incredibly hard to sift and getting harder every day. If you use them intelligently, you can find out incredible information. Given a couple of clues, I could probably find out a lot of things about most of you that you might not like me finding out. But what it tells me is that at a time when there's a greater abundance of information than there ever has been, it's harder to filter. We have greater tools. We have free internet tools that help us do this kind of investigation. We have algorithms that are smarter than ever before and computers that are quicker than ever before. But here's the thing. Algorithms are rules. They're binary. They're yes or no. They're black or white. Truth is never binary. Truth is a value. Truth is emotional. It's fluid. And above all, it's human. No matter how quick we get with computers, no matter how much information we have, you'll never be able to remove the human from the truth-seeking exercise, because in the end, it is a uniquely human trait.
And of course, right now, we are controlling the machines, so we are feeding the information into the computers. Of course, that may change. It's likely to change, unfortunately. So it's more important than ever, really, that in order not to get brainwashed, we humans educate ourselves. And we educate ourselves with facts. Facts is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. And you're going to come across people who tell you your facts are wrong, especially if you're a woman. And they don't take you seriously. And you're going to start questioning yourself, too, if the numbers are against you, if there are a horde of people who say something is so, and you really haven't done your homework and become the unique human being that actually has discovered the truth through research and maybe experience or a combination of both, and a thorough reading and absorption of the information that we have available to us through serious writings and informed speakers, such as the ones at TED. TED being a very remarkable organization. It's an acronym standing for Technology, Entertainment, Design, and it attracts some of the most brilliant people in their field, which is why in my search for knowledge and to share it with you, the listener, I will often quote extracts from TED speeches, tonight being no exception. I'm going to bring you now excerpts from a TED talk by journalist Michael Spector, who reiterates the position that we really have to do our due diligent curation to get to the truthful facts.
Listen, everyone's entitled to their opinion. But you know what you're not entitled to? You're not entitled to your own facts. Sorry, you're not. And this took me a while to figure out. About a decade ago, I wrote a story about vaccines for The New Yorker, a little story, and I was amazed to find opposition. Opposition to what is, after all, the most effective public health measure in human history. I didn't know what to do, so I just did what I do. I wrote a story and I moved on. And soon after that, I wrote a story about genetically engineered food. Same thing, only bigger. People were going crazy. So I wrote a story about that, too. And I couldn't understand why people thought this was Frankenfoods, why they thought moving molecules around in a specific rather than a haphazard way was trespassing on nature's ground. But, you know, I do what I do. I wrote this story. I moved on. I mean, I'm a journalist. We type, we file, we go to dinner. It's fine. But these stories bothered me, and I couldn't figure out why, and eventually I did. And that's because those fanatics that were driving me crazy weren't actually fanatics at all. They were thoughtful people, educated people, decent people. And it just disturbed me so much. But then I thought, you know, let's be honest. We're at a point in this world where we don't have the same relationship to progress that we used to. We talk about it ambivalently. We talk about it in ironic terms with little quotes around it. Progress. You know, let's pretend right here we have a machine. It's a time machine, and everyone has to get into it. You can go backwards, you can go forwards, you cannot stay where you are. I wonder what you'd choose, because I've been asking my friends this question a lot lately, and they all want to go back. I don't know, they want to go back before there were automobiles or Twitter or American Idol. I don't know. I'm convinced that there's some sort of pull to nostalgia, to wishful thinking, and I understand that. I'm not part of that crowd, I have to say. I don't want to go back, and it's not because I'm adventurous. It's because possibilities on this planet, they don't go back, they go forward. So I want to get in the machine, and I want to go forward. This is the greatest time there's ever been on this planet. By any measure that you wish to choose, health, wealth, mobility, opportunity, declining rates of disease, there's never been a time like this. My great-grandparents died, all of them, by the time they were 60. My grandparents pushed that number to 70. My parents are closing in on 80. There better be a 9 in the beginning of my death number. But it's not even about people like us, because this is a bigger deal than that. A kid born in New Delhi today can expect to live as long as the richest man in the world did 100 years ago. I mean, think about that. It's an incredible fact. And why is it true? Smallpox. Smallpox killed billions of people on this planet. It reshaped the demography of the globe in a way that no war ever has. It's gone. It's vanished. We vanquished it. Poof. In the rich world, diseases that threatened millions of us just a generation ago no longer exist, hardly. Diphtheria, rubella, polio, does anyone even know what those things are? Vaccines, modern medicine, our ability to feed billions of people, those are triumphs of the scientific method. And to my mind, the scientific method, trying stuff out, seeing if it works, changing it when it doesn't, is one of the great accomplishments of humanity. So that's the good news. Unfortunately, that's all the good news. Because there are some other problems, and they've been mentioned many times, and one of them is that despite all our accomplishments, a billion people go to bed hungry in this world every day. That number's rising, and it's rising really rapidly, and it's disgraceful. And not only that, we've used our imagination to thoroughly trash this globe. Potable water, arable land, rainforests, oil, gas, they're going away, and they're going away soon. And unless we innovate our way out of this mess, we're going away too. But here's the thing that keeps me up at night. One of the things that keeps me up at night. We've never needed progress in science more than we need it right now, never. And we've also never been in a position to deploy it properly in the way that we can today. We're on the verge of amazing, amazing events in many fields. And yet, I actually think we'd have to go back hundreds, 300 years before the Enlightenment to find a time when we battled progress, when we fought about these things more vigorously on more fronts than we do now. People wrap themselves in their beliefs, and they do it so tightly that you can't set them free. Not even the truth will set them free.
So, faith and facts, they don't always go together. And there's a reason why we sometimes cling to faith rather than fact, because we want to believe in miracles, and we feel that somehow we can change the magnetic field around us, the scientific world around us, with faith. Plus, faith is subjective, and those of us with a strong belief in either our own psychological powers or some mystical beings, or those of us who feel powerless, would rather fall into the arms of faith than battle with facts. Michael Spector, in his TED Talk that I'm bringing you now on this Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 935, tonight with facts as its topic, understands this and a proclivity to mistrust progress because it might steer us away from our faith into a world of someone else's facts. And those facts are so numerous and so contradictory sometimes and harsh that a world of facts doesn't feel as safe as a world of faith.
Okay, there are reasons. We've lost faith in institutions, in authority, and sometimes in science itself. And there's no reason we shouldn't have. You can just say a few names, and people will understand. Chernobyl, Bhopal, the Challenger, Vioxx, weapons of mass destruction, hanging chads. I mean, you can choose your list. There are questions and problems with the people we used to believe were always right. So be skeptical. Ask questions, demand proof, demand evidence. Don't take anything for granted. But here's the thing. When you get proof, you need to accept the proof. And we're not that good at doing that. And the reason that I can say that is because we're now in an epidemic of fear like one that I've never seen and hope never to see again. About 12 years ago, there was a story published, a horrible story, that linked the epidemic of autism to the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine shot. Very scary. Tons of studies were done to see if this was true. Tons of studies should have been done. It's a serious issue. The data came back. The data came back from the United States, from England, from Sweden, from Canada, and it was all the same. No correlation, no connection, none at all. Doesn't matter, because we believe anecdotes. We believe what we see, what we think we see, what makes us feel real. We don't believe a bunch of documents from a government official giving us data. And I do understand that. I think we all do. But you know what? The result of that has been disastrous. Disastrous. Because here's a fact. The United States is one of the only countries in the world where the vaccine rate for measles is going down. That is disgraceful, and we should be ashamed of ourselves. It's horrible. What kind of a thing happened that we could do that? Now, I understand it. I do understand it, because who, anyone have measles here? Does one person in this audience ever see someone die of measles? Doesn't happen very much. Doesn't happen in this country. It happened 160,000 times in the world last year. That's a lot of death of measles, 20 an hour. But since it didn't happen here, we can put it out of our minds, and people like Jenny McCarthy can go around preaching messages of fear and illiteracy from platforms like Oprah and Larry King Live. And they can do it because they don't link causation and correlation. They don't understand that these things seem the same, but they're almost never the same. And it's something we need to learn, and we need to learn it really soon. We have measles in this country now, and it's getting worse, and pretty soon kids are going to die again, because it's just a numbers game. And they're not just going to die of measles. What about polio? Let's have that. Jonas Salk was a hero. He took one of the worst scourges of mankind away from us. No fear, no agony, polio, poof, gone. A college classmate of mine wrote me a couple weeks ago and said she thought I was a little strident. No one's ever said that before. She wasn't going to vaccinate her kid against polio. No way. Fine. Why? Because we don't have polio. And you know what? We didn't have polio in this country yesterday. Today, I don't know, maybe a guy got on a plane in Lagos this morning and he's flying to LAX right now. He's over Ohio. And he's going to land in a couple hours, he's going to rent a car, and he doesn't know that he's infected with a paralytic disease, and we don't either. Because that's the way the world works. That's the planet we live on. Don't pretend it isn't. We love to wrap ourselves in lies. We love to do it. Everyone take their vitamins this morning? Echinacea, little antioxidant to get you going? I know you did, because half of Americans do every day. They take this stuff and they take alternative medicines, and it doesn't matter. Often we find out that they're useless. The data says it all the time. They darken your urine. They almost never do more than that. It's okay. You want to pay $28 billion for dark urine? I'm totally with you. Dark urine. Dark. Why do we do that? Why do we do that? Well, I think I understand. We hate big pharma. We hate big government. We don't trust the man. And we shouldn't. Our healthcare system sucks. It's cruel to millions of people. It's absolutely astonishingly cold and soul-deadening to those of us who can even afford it. So we run away from it, and where do we run? We leap into the arms of Big Placebo. Fantastic. I love Big Placebo. But it's really a serious thing, because this stuff is crap, and we spend billions of dollars on it. And you know what? When I say this stuff, people scream at me, and they say, what do you care? Let people do what they want to do. It makes them feel good. And you know what? You're wrong. Because I don't care if it's the Secretary of HHS who's saying, I'm not going to take the evidence of my experts on mammograms, or some cancer quack who wants to treat his patient with coffee enemas. When you start down the road where belief and magic replace evidence and science, you end up in a place you don't want to be. You end up in Thabo Mbeki, South Africa. He killed 400,000 of his people by insisting that beetroot, garlic, and lemon oil were much more effective than the antiretroviral drugs we know can slow the course of AIDS. Hundreds of thousands of needless deaths in a country that has been plagued worse than any other by this disease. Please, don't tell me there are no consequences to these things. There are. There always are. Now, the most mindless epidemic we're in the middle of right now is this absurd battle between proponents of genetically engineered food and the organic elite. It's an idiotic debate. It has to stop. It's a debate about words, about metaphors. It's ideology. It's not science. Every single thing we eat, every grain of rice, every sprig of parsley, every Brussels sprout has been modified by man. You know, there weren't tangerines in the Garden of Eden. There wasn't any cantaloupe. There weren't Christmas trees. We made it all. We made it over the last 11,000 years. And some of it worked and some of it didn't. We got rid of the stuff that didn't. Now we can do it in a more precise way. And there are risks. Absolutely. But we can put something like vitamin A into rice. And that stuff can help millions of people. Millions of people. Prolong their lives. Science isn't a company. It's not a country. It's not even an idea. It's a process. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But the idea that we should not allow science to do its job because we're afraid, I have to say, I don't understand it. You know, in the next 50 years, we're going to have to grow 70% more food than we do right now. 70%. And it's about time we started to understand what that meant. Because you know something? If we don't, if we continue to act the way we're acting, we're guilty of something that I don't think we want to be guilty of. High-tech colonialism. There's no other way to describe what's going on here. It's selfish, it's beneath us, and it's preventing millions of people from prospering.
So then, there are facts and misfacts, and in order to get at the truth, we need to be able to analyze facts with knowledge. Facts is what my KX95's Sharon Hour tonight, that's with me, Sharon James, is all about. I'm going to reintroduce you now to Michael Shermer. He's the director of the Skeptics Society, an organization dedicated to facts over Alice. He likens his organization to the bunco squad of police departments flushing out bad ideas.
This is an example of a bad idea called the Quadro 2000 dowser rod. It's a piece of plastic with a Radio Shack antenna attached to it, being sold to high school administrators for $900 a piece, and was built to douse for marijuana in students' lockers. So the way it works is you go down the hallway and you see if it tilts toward a particular locker, and then you open the lockers. I'll show you in it. Well, it has kind of a right-leaning bias. Well, so the question was, can it actually find marijuana in students' lockers? And the answer is, if you open enough of them, yes. But in science, we have to keep track of the misses, not just the hits, and that's probably the key lesson to my short talk, that this is how psychics work, astrologers and tarot card readers and so on. People remember the hits, they forget the misses. In science, we have to keep the whole database and look to see if the number of hits is somehow stands out from the total number that you would expect by chance. In this case, we tested it. We had two opaque boxes, one with government-approved THC marijuana and one with nothing, and it got it 50% of the time, which is exactly what you'd expect with a coin flip model.
The thing is with science, it's not haphazard. Well, certainly not as haphazard as us acting on anecdotal information that hasn't been substantiated. Provable facts emerge from rigorous testing, whether they're scientific facts or incidental facts that people present as life-changing. One recent controversy emerged actually from a scientific field of study, and since I've been using a lot of TED speakers here on this, my KX935's Sharon Hour tonight dedicated to the topic of facts, it's notable that it involved the second most listened to speaker on TED. She got about 43 million views, was creeping up on my good friend Ken Robinson, who's actually the number one ever speaker on TED still, I think, with his 47 million views. So Amy Cuddy, you might have been one of those 43 million listening to her talk, presented a revolutionary way of women empowering themselves in a business arena and a conference arena by practicing a particular stance, a power stance in the mirror. She had done a study on this and presented it as a proven fact that if you adopted this power stance, very simple, basically just holding yourself upright and confident, and as I said, practicing it in the mirror, you would then become this powerful, confident person that you were posing as. Well, maybe out of jealousy, you know, people make a huge success of something and there are always people coming up behind who suddenly want to push them off their pedestal. I'm not exactly sure of the facts here, but it seems that she hadn't effectively worked through the P factor, the probability factor of this being an accepted psychological fact. She hadn't done enough studies, whatever it was. I think it had something to do with the fact that if participants in a research project get wind of actually what the researcher is hoping to prove from it, they'll adjust their responses to somehow influence, for the better or worse, what the researcher is testing, usually to try to make it come out the way the researcher wants it to, even if they aren't consciously aware of it. So when you do these control experiments, the participants aren't supposed to know exactly what is being tested. It was something like that anyway. Even though her talk had a huge success and probably did encourage women to adopt a pose and feel more powerful as a result, because it didn't follow the rigors of scientific data, Amy Cuddy was vilified within her community, talks were cancelled. She ultimately rose above it, but it just goes to show that having facts at your disposal, offering them up to a greater audience, might make you the most popular person in the room for a bit, but can cause your downfall as much as heresy can. which is an upsetting thought, isn't it? I guess the lesson is, if you have some facts to impart, don't blow your horn too loudly. I still want to hear from these people who have some scientific information to offer. Everything's fallible in this world after all, isn't it? It's the impetus for sharing new helpful facts that's important. It's certainly what I try to do on this KX935 share an hour, though there are also con artists out there who just want to do it for profit. Anyway, let's get back to Michael Shermer, the skeptic. He's a man whose head is firmly rooted in science, and he has no faith, like most skeptics, in anything extraterrestrial and or divine.
Are science and religion compatible? It's like, is science and plumbing compatible? They're just two different things. Don't think of skepticism as a thing, or even science as a thing. Science is not a thing, it's a verb. It's a way of thinking about things. It's a way of looking for natural explanations for all phenomena. You can say a miracle occurs, it's just that it doesn't explain anything. It doesn't offer anything. There's nothing to test. And it's true, scientists sometimes throw terms out as linguistic place fillers, dark energy or dark matter or something like that. Until we figure out what it is, we'll just call it this. It's the beginning of the causal chain for science. It's the end of the conversation for intelligent design creationists. I mean, what's more likely, that extraterrestrial intelligences or multidimensional beings travel across the vast distances of interstellar space to leave a crop circle in Farmer Bob's field in Puckerbrush, Kansas to promote skeptic.com our webpage? Or is it more likely that a reader of Skeptic did with Photoshop? In all cases, we have to ask, what's the more likely explanation? And before we say something is out of this world, we should first make sure that it's not in this world.
Michael Shermer holds up a photograph claiming it was a UFO sighting.
This UFO shot from my house in Altadena, California, looking down over Pasadena. And if it looks a lot like a Buick hubcap, it's because it is. You don't even need Photoshop. You don't need high-tech equipment. You don't need computers. This was shot with a throwaway Kodak Instamatic camera. You just have somebody off on the side with a hubcap ready to go. Camera's ready. That's it. So, although it's possible that most of these things are fake or illusions or so on, and that some of them are real, it's more likely that all of them are fake, like the crop circles. On a more serious note, in all of science, we're looking for a balance between data and theory. In the case of Galileo, he had two problems when he turned his telescope to Saturn. First of all, there was no theory of planetary rings, and second of all, his data was grainy and fuzzy, and he couldn't quite make out what it was he was looking at. So he wrote that he has seen, I have observed that the furthest planet has three bodies. So without a theory of planetary rings and with only grainy data, you can't have a good theory. And it wasn't solved until Christian Huygens had two things. He had a good theory of planetary rings and how the solar system operated, and then he had better telescopic, more fine-grained data in which he could figure out that as the Earth is going around faster, according to Kepler's laws, than Saturn, then we catch up with it and we see the rings at different angles. The problems with having a theory is that your theory may be loaded with cognitive biases. So one of the problems of explaining why people believe weird things is that we have things on a simple level, like we have a tendency to see faces, the face on Mars in 1976, so there was a whole movement to get NASA to photograph that area because people thought this was monumental architecture made by Martians. Well, if you squint, you can see the face. And when you're squinting, what you're doing is you're turning that from fine grain to coarse grain, and so you're reducing the quality of your data. And if I didn't tell you what to look for, you'd still see the face because we're programmed by evolution to see faces. Faces are important for us socially. Humans are pattern-seeking animals. Virgin Mary on the side of a glass window in Clearwater, Florida. I actually went to see this one. There was a lot of people there of the faithful come to be there in wheelchairs and crutches and so on. And we went down and investigated. So many thousands of candles people had lit in tribute to this. So we walked around the backside just to see what was going on here. It turns out wherever there's a sprinkler head and a palm tree, you get the effect. Here's the Virgin Mary on the backside, which they started to wipe off. I guess you can only have one miracle per building.
It's true, the vision that Michael Shermer is holding up in this his TED talk shows sort of diaphanous streaks in the form of a woman's veil, and it is all over every aspect of the building. And there are window cleaners in the photograph he's showing, wiping it off the back. But we do love these kind of illusions. We love any evidence that there is a divine presence. It's in our nature. But facts versus illusions is the topic of my Sharon R tonight on Laguna's KX935. That's with me, Sharon James. And currently you're listening to head of the Skeptics Society, Michael Shermer. try to steer us away from being drawn to these illusions by giving us some factual content that would debunk them.
There's this film White Noise with Michael Keaton about the dead talking back to us. By the way, this whole business of talking to the dead, it's not that big a deal. Anybody can do it. Turns out it's getting the dead to talk back. That's the really hard part. In this case, supposedly these messages are hidden in electronic phenomenon. There's a reversespeech.com webpage in which I downloaded this stuff. This is the most famous one of all of these. Here's the forward version of the very famous song.
If there's a bustle in your hedgerow, don't be alone there.
All right, here it is backwards, and see if you can hear the hidden messages that are supposedly in there. What'd you get? Satan. Okay, well, at least we got Satan. Now, I will prime your auditory part of your brain to tell you what you're supposed to hear, and then hear it again.
Michael Shermer has printed up the lyrics that we're supposed to be hearing when he plays the song backwards. Here's to my sweet Satan, the one whose little path would make me sad, whose power is Satan. He'll give you 666. There was a little tool shed where he made us suffer, sad Satan. Now you're being asked to listen again and see if you get any of that from what you just heard.
I can't miss it when I tell you what's there.
It's true, isn't it? When there's something that we don't quite understand, we use the bits that we do understand to piece some narrative together that is probably completely false. We just fill in the gaps. But when it comes to substantive truths that are being presented to the world as facts, it's not up to us to speculate. It's harmful to fill in the gaps. And people in positions of power try to do that a lot, knowing that we won't be bothered to dig deeper. So it's really incumbent on us to think about and research the facts to get at an actual truth rather than a more intentionally subversive one. Facts is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. Not just scientific facts, but incidental facts, everyday facts. Facts presented to us as truths, because fact is really a synonym for truth. And that's important on an ethical level, but it also can be fun to be a repository of facts and truths. And as my next speaker, Ken Jennings, I think still the number one Jeopardy winner to date, can attest, can also make a lot of money and fame out of knowing facts, even if on the way there you're dismissed as a nerd.
Occasionally I still get recognized at the mall. And when I do, it's as a bit of a know-it-all. For better or for worse, that's what I'm going to be known as the guy who knew a lot of weird stuff. And I can't complain about this. I feel like that was always sort of my destiny, although I had for many years been pretty deeply in the trivia closet. If nothing else, you realize very quickly as a teenager, it is not a hit with girls to know Captain Kirk's middle name, you know? And as a result, I was sort of the deeply closeted kind of know-it-all for many years. But if you go further back, if you look at it, it's all there. I was the kind of kid who was always bugging mom and dad with whatever great fact I had just read about Halley's Comet or giant squids or the size of the world's biggest pumpkin pie or, you know, whatever it was. I now have a 10-year-old of my own who's exactly the same. And I know how deeply annoying it is, so karma does work. And I loved game shows, fascinated with game shows. I remember crying on my first day of kindergarten back in 1979 because it had just hit me, as badly as I wanted to go to school, that I was also going to miss like Hollywood Squares and Family Feud. And later, in the mid-80s, when Jeopardy came back on the air, I remember running home from school every day to watch the show. It was always my favorite show. We lived overseas. We lived in South Korea, where my dad was working, where there was only one English language TV channel. There was Armed Forces TV, and if you didn't speak Korean, that's what you were watching. So me and all my friends would run home every day and watch Jeopardy. I was always that kind of obsessed trivia kid. I remember loving being able to play Trivial Pursuit against my parents back in the 80s and hold my own. There's a weird sense of mastery you get when you know some bit of boomer trivia that mom and dad don't know. You know, you know some Beatles factoid that the dad didn't know, and you think, aha, knowledge really is power. The power of the right fact deployed in exactly the right place. I never had a guidance counselor who thought this was a legitimate career path, that thought you could major in trivia or be a professional ex-game show contestant. And so I sold out way too young. I didn't try to figure out what one does with that. I studied computers because I heard that was the thing, and I became a computer programmer. Not especially good one, not an especially happy one at the time when I was first on Jeopardy in 2004. But that's what I was doing. And I made it sort of doubly ironic, my computer background, a few years later when I got another phone call from Jeopardy saying, it's early days yet, but IBM tells us they want to build a supercomputer to beat you at Jeopardy. Are you up for this? And of course I said yes, you know, for several reasons. One, because playing Jeopardy is a great time. It's fun. It's the most fun you can have with your pants on, and I would do it for nothing. Like I don't think they know that, luckily, but I would go back and play for Arby's coupons. I just love Jeopardy. And I always have. And second of all, because I'm sort of a nerdy guy and this seemed like the future. People playing computers on game shows was the kind of thing I always imagined would happen in the future, and now I could be on the stage with it. I was not going to say no. The third reason I said yes is because I was pretty confident that I was going to win. I had taken some artificial intelligence classes. I knew there were no computers that could do what you need to do to win on Jeopardy. People don't realize how tough it is to write that kind of program that can read a Jeopardy clue in a natural language like English and understand all the double meanings, the puns, the red herrings, unpack the meaning of the clue, the kind of thing that a 3 or 4 year old human, a little kid, could do. Very hard for a computer. And I thought, well, this is just going to be child's play. Yes, I will come destroy the computer and defend my species. But as the years went on, you know, as IBM started throwing money and manpower and processor speed at this, I started to get a little more worried.
Watson, the name given to the computer, was starting to look like a formidable competitor for all-time Jeopardy winner Ken Jennings, whose TED Talk you're listening to now on this The Sharon Hour, me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. Jennings is hoping he can defend humanity by proving we humans ultimately have a more thorough grasp of facts than a computer.
When the game eventually happened, it was very different than the Jeopardy games I'd been used to. We were not playing in L.A. on the regular Jeopardy set. Watson does not travel. Watson's actually huge. It's, you know, thousands of processors, a terabyte of memory, trillions of bytes of memory. We got to walk through his climate-controlled server room. The only other Jeopardy contestant to this day I've ever been inside. And so Watson does not travel. You must come to it. You must make the pilgrimage. So me and the other human player wound up at this sort of secret IBM research lab in the middle of these snowy woods in Westchester County to play the computer. And we realized right away that the computer had a big home court advantage. There was a big Watson logo in the middle of the stage. And the crowd was full of IBM VPs and programmers cheering on their little darling and having poured millions of dollars into this, hoping against hope that the humans screw up, and holding up Go Watson signs and just applauding like pageant moms every time their little darling got one right. But they were right. They were exactly right. I don't want to spoil it if you still have this sitting on your DVR, but Watson won handily. And I remember standing there behind that podium as I could hear that little insectoid thumb clicking. It had a robot thumb that was clicking on the buzzer, and you could hear that little tick, 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 tick. And I remember thinking, you know, this is it. I felt obsolete. I felt like a Detroit factory worker of the 80s seeing a robot that could now do his job on the assembly line. I felt like quiz show contestant was now the first job that had become obsolete under this new regime of thinking computers. And it hasn't been the last. If you watch the news, and I see this all the time, you know, that pharmacists now, there's a machine that can fill prescriptions automatically without actually needing a human pharmacist. And a lot of law firms are getting rid of paralegals because there's software that can sum up case laws and legal briefs and decisions. You don't need human assistance for that anymore. I read the other day about a program where you feed it a box score from a baseball or a football game and it spits out a news article as if a human had watched the game and was commenting on it. And obviously these new technologies can't do as clever or creative a job as the humans they're replacing. But they're faster. And crucially, they're much, much cheaper. So it makes me wonder what the economic effects of this might be. I've read economists saying that as a result of these new technologies, we'll enter a new golden age of leisure, when we'll all have time for the things we really love because all these onerous tasks will be taken over by Watson and his digital brethren. I've heard other people say quite the opposite, that this is yet another tier of the middle class that's having the thing they can do taken away from them by a new technology, and that this is actually something ominous, something that we should worry about. I'm not an economist myself. All I know is how it felt to be the guy put out of work, and it was freaking demoralizing. It was terrible. Here's the one thing that I was ever good at, and all it took was IBM pouring tens of millions of dollars in its smartest people and thousands of processors working in parallel, and they could do the same thing. They could do it a little bit faster and a little better on national TV, and I'm sorry, Ken, we don't need you anymore. And it made me think, what does this mean if we're going to be able to start outsourcing not just low or unimportant brain functions? You know, like I'm sure many of you remember a distant time when we had to know phone numbers, you know, when we knew our friends' phone numbers. And suddenly there was a machine that did that, and now we don't need to remember that anymore. I have read that there's now actually evidence that the hippocampus, the part of our brain that handles spatial relationships, physically shrinks and atrophies in people who use tools like GPS, because we're not exercising our sense of direction anymore. We're just obeying a little talking voice on our dashboard. And as a result, the part of our brain that's supposed to do that kind of stuff gets smaller and dumber. And it made me think, what happens when computers are now better at knowing and remembering stuff than we are? Is all of our brain going to start to shrink and atrophy like that? Are we as a culture going to start to value knowledge less? As somebody who has always believed in the importance of the stuff that we know, this was a terrifying idea to me.
You see, here's the thing that is rather terrifying about our computer age. If we do become obsolete repositories of facts, if we secede at all to the Googles and the IBMs and these digital instruments that are commercial productions, profit-making, and they're making such huge amounts of profits for their creators that those people become de facto the most powerful people in the world. And they're, let's not forget, programming these computers. What does happen to us as individuals if the facts are taken away from us, if the truths, because facts equal truths, are taken away from us and or somehow distorted for somebody else's purpose? I mean, it's a dystopian view, but, you know, not such a far-fetched one given the way we see the world going at the moment. Facts is the topic on my Share and Now tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Lunas KX 935. And I'm currently playing you a TED Talk from Jeopardy's all-time winner, Ken Jennings, who took on competing with an IBM computer called Watson several years ago and was also disturbed by the fact that he lost quite soundly to him. It made him question whether we humans were going to become obsolete, at least the less powerful ones of us. Not such a far-fetched idea.
But the more I thought about it, I realized, no, the things we know are still important. I came to believe there were two advantages that those of us who have these things in our head have over somebody who says, I can Google that, hold on a second. There's an advantage of volume and there's an advantage of time. The advantage of volume first has to do with the complexity of the world nowadays. There's so much information out there. Being a Renaissance man or woman, that's something that was only possible in the Renaissance. Now it's really not possible to be reasonably educated on every field of human endeavor. There's just too much. They say that the scope of human information is now doubling every 18 months or so, the sum total of human information. We generate as much information in terms of gigabytes as all of humanity has in all the previous millennia put together. It's doubling every 18 months now. This is terrifying because a lot of the big decisions we make require the mastery of lots of different kinds of facts. A decision like, where do I go to school? What should I major in? Who do I vote for? Do I take this job or that one? You know, these are the decisions that require correct judgments about many different kinds of facts. If we have those facts at our mental fingertips, we're going to be able to make informed decisions. If, on the other hand, we need to look them all up, we may be in trouble. According to a National Geographic survey I just saw, somewhere along the lines of 80% of the people who vote in a U.S. presidential election about issues like foreign policy cannot find Iraq or Afghanistan on a map. If you can't do that first step, are you really going to look up the other 1,000 facts you're going to need to know to master your knowledge of U.S. foreign policy? Why, probably not. At some point, you're just going to be like, you know what? That's too much to know. Screw it. And you'll make a less informed decision. The other issue is the advantage of time that you have if you have all these things at your fingertips. I always think of the story of a little girl named Lee Smith. She was a 10-year-old girl from Surrey, England, on vacation with her parents a few years ago in Phuket, Thailand. She runs up to them on the beach one morning, and says, "Mom, Dad, we got to get off the beach." And they say, "What do you mean? We just got here." And she said, "Well, in Mr. Kearney's geography class last month, he told us that when the tide goes out abruptly out to sea and you see the waves churning way out there, that's the sign of a tsunami, and you need to clear the beach." You know, what would you do if your 10-year-old daughter came up to you with this? Her parents thought about it, and they finally, to their credit, decided to believe her. They told the lifeguard, they went back to the hotel, and the lifeguard cleared over 100 people off the beach. Luckily, because that was the day of the Boxing Day tsunami, the day after Christmas, 2004, that killed, I don't know, thousands of people in Southeast Asia and around the Indian Ocean. But not on that beach, not on Maikau Beach, because this little girl had remembered one fact from her geography teacher a month before. I love that story, because it shows you the power of one fact, one remembered fact, in exactly the right place at the right time. Normally something that's easier to see on game shows than in real life. But in this case, it happened in real life. And it happens in real life all the time. It's not always a tsunami. Often it's a social situation. It's a meeting or job interview or first date or some relationship that gets lubricated because two people realize they share some common piece of knowledge in common. You say where you're from, and I say, "Oh, yeah," or your alma mater or your job, and I know just a little something about it, enough to get the ball rolling. People love that shared connection that gets created when somebody knows something about you. It's like they took the time to get to know you before you even met. And it's not effective if you say, "Well, hold on, you're from Fargo, North Dakota. Let me see what comes up." That doesn't work. That's just annoying. The great 18th century British theologian and thinker, friend of Dr. Johnson, Samuel Parr, once said, "It's always better to know a thing than not to know it." And if I have lived my life by any kind of creed, it's probably that. I have always believed that the knowledge is an absolute good, that the things we have learned and carry with us in our heads are what make us who we are, as individuals and as a species. I don't know if I want to live in a world that knowledge isn't valuable because it's all out there in the cloud, and why would we ever bother learning anything new? I don't want to live in a world where cultural literacy has been replaced by these little bubbles of specialty so that none of us know about the common associations that used to bind our civilization together. I don't want to be the last trivia know-it-all sitting on a mountain somewhere reciting to himself the state capitals and the names of Simpsons episodes and the lyrics of ABBA songs. You know, I feel like our civilization works when this is a vast cultural heritage that we all share and that we know without having to outsource it to our devices, to our search engines and our smartphones. No, every day we should be striving to learn something new. We should have this unquenchable curiosity for the world around us. That's where the people you see on Jeopardy come from. These know-it-alls, they're not Rain Man-style savants sitting at home memorizing the phone book. I've met a lot of them. For the most part, they are just normal folks who are universally interested in the world around them, curious about everything, thirsty for this knowledge about whatever subject. So we can live in a world where our brains, the things that we know, continue to be the thing that makes us special, or a world in which we've outsourced all of that to evil supercomputers from the future. The choice is yours.
They don't have to be evil, but they can be instruments of propaganda. And they can, even without evil intent, fail us because they can be elliptical and lacking in the sentient, empathetic quality of the best human beings. That's pretty much my show tonight, but I'm going to leave you with a little sampling of how computers can fail us as reason enough for knowing our own truths and facts. Facts having been the topic of this KX935's Share an Hour tonight. If you want to hear the show again, you can hear it on iTunes or on our dedicated website, kx935.com. And please do come back and hear more Sharon Hours with me, Sharon James, every Sunday night at 6.
My instructor was Mr. Langley, and he taught me to sing a song. If you'd like to hear it, I can sing it for you.
Yes. I'd like to hear it, Hal. Sing it for me.
It's called Daisy. 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 Give me your answer, do. I'm half crazy. All for the love of